And did you hear on my mind every hour of the day without your sweet inspiration?
Everybody, it's Tuesday night once again. It's 7 p.m. on the Left Coast, and it's time for the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. This is Tammy Jackson, in fact, welcoming you to an hour of sweet conservative inspiration. As I tell you every single week, if you care to do so, interact with comments and questions on Twitter during the show. You can follow me at Tammy J, T-A-M-I-J. Now let's get rolling. My first guest tonight is Eric Brakey. Eric Brakey is an American politician, the state senator in Maine for District 20. He defeated the Democratic challenger, Kimberly Sampson, with 62% of the vote. That's a pretty darn good percentage right there. He was the Maine state director for the 2012 Ron Paul presidential campaign, winning a majority of Maine delegates to seats in the 2012 Republican National Convention. After working for Ron Paul's 2012 presidential campaign, Brakey led Defense of Liberty PAC, a libertarian political action committee in Maine. Now, Eric Brakey is running for U.S. Senate. Eric Brakey, welcome to the show.
Tammy, I'm so glad to be on with you. Thank you for having me this evening.
Well, you're sure welcome. I was anxious to have you on. I have a lot of people on that are running for office all over the United States because I just want to highlight good people that are trying to do this and trying to be public servants according to the U.S. Constitution. That's the way it was supposed to be. You were supposed to leave private life, get there and be a public servant in your state capital or in our nation's capital and work for a while for the things your constituents wanted and then go back home to regular life. And that's what you're trying to do right now. I don't know a whole lot about you, Eric Brakey. I know you're from Maine, and I don't know that much. Maine, I've been to Bangor, Maine, just stopped there on the way to and from an international flight. But otherwise, I don't know that much about Maine. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Were you born and raised in Maine? Did you come from a conservative family? What's the story?
You know, my family goes back here in Maine for 10 generations. I can trace it all the way back to the Mayflower. My parents met here in the second grade, went off to college, and sadly, they ran into a problem when they graduated from college that so many young Maine people still run into, which is they graduated, they got their degrees, and they looked around where the jobs were, and they ended up moving. Elsewhere in the country. We came back to Maine every single summer. My parents always wanted to retire back this way. When I got old enough, I ended up coming back this way and making Maine my permanent home. And my parents finally made their way back to Maine as well. But I'll tell you a little bit about kind of my journey in politics, because it really started for me in a big way in 2010 in the Tea Party wave, when people were getting really upset about, then it was the $13 trillion of debt. And we thought, geez, $13 trillion, that's such a big number. How are we ever going to pay this off? And now I look back and think, well, geez, $13 trillion, those were the good old days. Now we're up to 21.
Right.
But as a younger person, I was graduating from college that year. As a younger person, I was very concerned about this. This was going to fall on me and my generation and all the generations to follow. We were being saddled with this, with these debts before we even got to come out into the world and try to make something of our lives. And it was about that time that actually my older brother handed me a book by Congressman Ron Paul. It was Ron Paul's The Revolution, a Manifesto. And that book really opened my eyes to so many of the ways that, you know, I had grown up thinking, you know, in a conservative household where Fox News was on the TV, Rush Limbaugh was on the radio. I'd grown up thinking just this Republican good, Democrat bad, and I kind of believed that there was this simplistic version of the world. And I really came to understand in the Tea Party wave and with Ron Paul and others that, you know what, it was the establishment in both parties that was creating these problems. They were racking up the debts, eroding our constitutional liberties. You know, I graduated from college and I went off to New York City. I was working there actually for about 2 years. I was working as a professional actor. That's actually what I got earned my degree in. I studied theater. I was working as a professional actor in New York City, but I started started showing up to debate watch parties with this local grassroots group of Ron Paul supporters, and I just kept showing up, and they noticed that I kept showing up, and so they just started giving me responsibilities. They said, hey, design these flyers, or hey, go, we're going to be tabling out in Union Square to identify supporters. Come with us. And I would go and do that, and you know what? Before I knew it, I was helping to run the whole organization. You know, you keep showing up, and you do well with the responsibilities that you're given, and you end up being given more responsibilities. Right. And it was at a certain point in time in 2011 when someone encouraged me to apply for a job on the Ron Paul campaign. And I said no at first. I had my life all planned out for me. I loved working in the theater. That was my love. That was my passion, working in the arts. But it got real. It finally hit me that, you know, this was a crucial moment in America. I thought we were at a turning point, and I had the opportunity to make a difference. So I did apply for a job with the campaign. I interviewed and was offered a position. They actually wanted to send me out to Colorado, but I requested to go to Maine, where my family goes back for generations and generations. I went out there. I was a field staffer, ended up being eventually promoted to the state director, the statewide director for the campaign. As you mentioned, we ended up winning that race in Maine. We were one of the few states that Ron Paul won. We elected all Republican national delegates to the national convention from Maine. Of course, the Mitt Romney campaign wasn't happy about that. The RNC wasn't happy about that. There was a whole blow up at the national convention in 2012 when they tried to unseat our delegates, including myself. That's its own story that people can go back and look through the news articles from the time there. But you know what? I learned from that campaign an important lesson. I learned that what those who believe in liberty and our Constitution can accomplish when you have a plan, you are organized, and you're willing to do what it takes to follow through and carry out that plan. We organized the grassroots across the state tremendously effectively. We essentially took over the Maine Republican Party that year. They called it the biggest coup in recent Maine political history when we won that convention. I ended up, we started the Defense of Liberty PAC, helping to elect Liberty Republicans to the state legislature. And 2 years later, I ran for the state Senate in 2014. I ran against a 36-year Democrat politician who'd been in office 36 years, never lost a race. He'd been the mayor of the biggest city of the district. He'd been city council. He'd been registered probate in the state Senate for 10 years, done everything except for dog catcher, never lost once. And I was just 26 years old. I was a young person. People told me I had no chance whatsoever. I was just a little guy challenging a big guy, David challenging Goliath. And people said, you know what, Eric, it's cute. It's cute that you think that you have a chance. It's cute that you think you can run and you can win. But the truth is, you can't. You don't have a chance. But you know what? I kind of shrugged that off. I thought that the cause of liberty was worth fighting for. So I went out. I knocked on 8,000 doors. I talked directly with Maine people about limited government, personal liberty, getting government out of our lives, minding its own business. And in that race, they said that we had no chance whatsoever. Ended up winning in an 18-point landslide with 59 to 41 against this longtime incumbent. And I got to Augusta, our state capital, and I like to think that I kept the promises that I made on the campaign trail. One of the very first things I did, and this was in divided government, Democrats controlled the House of Representatives, Republicans controlled the Senate, and pretty much every single major piece of legislation was dying in one body or the other because people couldn't get along. But one of the very first thing I did was I sponsored constitutional carry.
To ask you about that.
I put that bill in. People thought there was no chance at all that we were going to pass it. Democrats were in control of the House. How were we ever going to pass constitutional carry? But you know what? I just went out and I talked to people. I talked to our fellow legislators. I got close to 100 co-sponsors between the House and the Senate. A majority of the legislature co-sponsored this bill. I just went out and I just talked to people. And of course, it helped too that we had a lot of grassroots people back home who were putting pressure on their legislators to do the right thing and give us our constitutional rights back. Now, Michael Bloomberg and the anti-gun interests dumped a lot of money into trying to stop this from happening, but we passed it. We became the sixth state in the nation to pass constitutional carry, and now, just a few years later, we're up to 12 nationwide. There's an old saying in Maine, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. And I think that's proving true with constitutional carry. I've also been the Senate chairman for the Health and Human Services Committee, where I led the fight for welfare reform. We passed legislation to prohibit the purchase of alcohol, cigarettes, lottery tickets, welfare dollars. We instituted work requirements for able-bodied adults on welfare benefits to ensure that this program is functioning. These programs are functioning as a hand up, not a handout. Also, championed right-to-try legislation, nullifying federal FDA policy, giving terminally ill patients the right to try non-FDA-approved medications. And I have to hand it to President Trump, because after we passed it in Maine, and I actually led the fight in 2016 to get right-to-try in the national Republican platform, the House, the Senate on the federal level passed it, and President Trump signed that into law, giving terminally ill patients their right to choose with these medications. So that's a bit of me in a nutshell. And as you mentioned before, when I ran for re-election, you know, I was ranked the most conservative voting member in the Maine Senate by the American Conservative Union every year I've been in office. When I ran for re-election in my Democrat-leaning district, not only did they re-elect me, they re-elected me by a bigger margin the second time. And I think that just speaks to the appreciation people have when you stand up for principle. So many people stick their finger in the wind to see which way it's blowing. And, you know, frankly, when I got to the state capitol, people told me, Eric, you've got to moderate yourself to get reelected, because people won't vote for you if you have this just principled voting record, and you don't do just you don't give people all the free money and the welfare benefits. But you know what? People appreciate leaders who will stand up and lead on what they believe to be right. And I believed, you know what, there's no guarantees in life. I would rather stand and fight for what I believe in for 2 years and go home with my head held high than just do what everyone else was gonna do. So I'm proud of my record in the Maine Senate. I'm running for the U.S. Senate now against an incumbent, Angus King, who frankly people tell me all the time exactly the same things they told me when I ran for that first race. They tell me he's a big guy. You're a little guy. You have no chance. But you know what? I think that the message of liberty is powerful, and that's what we're running on. I want to get Washington, D.C. to leave us alone. I want Washington, D.C. to follow our Constitution. And I have spent a lot of time talking about myself, and I haven't let you get a word in edgewise.
Well, you know, it's funny because I do have an occasional guest on that getting a word or two out of them is like pulling teeth, and it's real tough. And I've just been smiling, thinking, well, okay, I should have just had Eric on.
Well, that's my life story, and however long that took.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I asked you to tell your story. That's fantastic. And I was going to ask you anyway about the constitutional carry, because I am a big proponent of the Second Amendment and speak on it frequently, by the way. And Bloomberg has also dumped a lot of money here in Oregon. So I know exactly what you're up against. These people have a lot of money. They like to spend it. Interesting, Eric Brakey, that a lot of the people that have all this money that pour it into states for anti-gun legislation, they're the ones with millions of dollars, personal security teams, walls around their mansions, etc. So it doesn't even really touch them. It touches the average citizen that has the constitutional right to bear arms. And I would like to see constitutional carry in a lot of other states. One thing that's interesting to me is I would think in places like Massachusetts and Vermont and Maine and all these states that were so close to Lexington and Concord and the shot heard around the world, that they would understand that it's imperative that we have an armed citizenry. And if it wasn't for our forebears having firearms, although my forebears were in Norway. I'm a granddaughter of legal Norwegian immigrants. I tell that on air all the time. But we would have been the slaves of tyrannical King George III had the people not had firearms back
right.
at...
You're absolutely right. You know, the shot heard around the world was from, you know, people standing up to tyrannical government trying to take their guns away. You know, when the Michael Bloombergs of the world are pushing gun control, we have to understand this isn't about controlling the guns. It's about controlling people. Because you tell me who in a society is allowed to own firearms, and I will tell you who is in charge of that society. If the government is allowed to own guns and the people are not allowed to own guns, then the people are not in charge of that country. Because if you are not trusted with the means of self-defense, with the means to be able to stand up for yourself should government ever become tyrannical, then you are not a free person. You are not a citizen. You are a subject.
Yes, absolutely right. My guest for this half hour is Eric Brakey. He's running for the U.S. Senate. He's up in Maine. I'll be back with him shortly. The Tammy Jackson Show is sponsored by Robart Companies. I tell you about them every single week. They are a true custom firearms and firearms finishing shop. They're located in Phoenix, Arizona, found at robartguns.com. You know, you've heard me talk about their superlative gunsmithing and about their finishes, especially NP3. But I've also mentioned briefly, I want to mention it again, that Robart is going to debut Armor Lube. It is a new coating that has been described by chemists and others as harder than diamonds. This is simply amazing. Armor Lube coatings are created from a proprietary carbon-based formula. The carbon provides a natural, what they call a graphitic lubricity, with an extremely low coefficient of friction that is less than 0.08. That's amazing. Armor Lube can be applied to a lot of internals on guns, to hammers, bolts, bolt carriers, other parts in automatic and semi-automatic rifles, as well as pistols. And my Glock 19 Gen 3 is being worked on at Robart at this very minute, pretty much being turned into a special operatives special Glock, and it will include Armor Lube coating. I can't wait to shoot with it. I'll talk about it when I get it back and have had it to the range. So if you need to give your worn firearm new life, check out robartguns.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show.
On the 405.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
I love Tammy.
I love you back, Kurt, because I'm a caring kind of gal.
The Tammy Jackson Show.
I'm just one conservative gal encouraging you to keep fighting the good fight.
Tammy is what conservative insurgency is about.
Tammy Jackson, the granddaughter of legal immigrants.
In Honduras, they had 60,000 murders per 100,000, or something like that. And I thought, whoa, that is a lot.
Like every other person on the block is dead.
Tammy Jackson, the emerging threat from the West Coast.
Tammy has made herself into a rising radio star.
When we have these mass amounts just suddenly pour into the United States, we have a worse problem than we already have had with assimilation.
The Tammy Jackson Show, Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, only on the 405media.com.
Anything for you, Tammy.
The 405.
Let's talk tech. Tech news discussions from the people in the industry right here in Pittsburgh. Online, gadgets, startups, and more. Check it out at awesomecast.net.
AwesomeCast. It's all about tech and it's all about gadgets. It's AwesomeCast, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on the 405media.com.
405.
This is Mike from the Wrestling Mayhem Show, the show where we get fans and people in the wrestling industry together to talk about pro wrestling, WWE, NXT, WrestleMania, all kinds of fun. It's a podcast party. Check it out. Wrestling Mayhem Show right here on the 405 Media.
Listen to the Wrestling Mayhem Show now 7 nights a week, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, right here on the 405media.com.
You're on the 405.
This is Tammy Jackson, back with my guest, Eric Brakey. If you're just joining the show, Eric Brakey is a state senator in Maine who is running to unseat incumbent U.S. Senator Angus King. King is an independent. And, of course, Susan Collins is a senior senator from Maine. We all know about Susan Collins. I absolutely call her a Republican in name only. So, Eric Brakey, we've been talking about the Constitution. You're very big on the Constitution, as every public servant should be. Every U.S. citizen actually should be. You're big on the Second Amendment. Let's talk a little bit about immigration. I told you in the first segment that I am the granddaughter of legal Norwegian immigrants, and I'm appalled at the steady flow of illegals coming into America. I hear people, Eric Brakey, say that unless someone's committed a crime, they shouldn't be arrested or deported. But the very act of coming here illegally is a crime. So what are your ideas for immigration?
Well, first I'll say, you know, I think you're absolutely right on one thing, which is, of course, we are a nation of legal immigrants, people who came here legally through our legal processes, pursuing the American dream and wanting to make a better life for themselves. And that's wonderful. That's a part of the American success story. But, you know, when it comes to those who are calling for open borders and just allowing anyone to come here without any vetting, without any following our laws, you know, there's a couple reasons why that would be just very problematic for America. I always go back first and foremost to what, you know, Nobel Prize winning economist Milton Friedman once said, which is, it's just obvious you can't have open borders and a welfare state. And yet the welfare state grows bigger and bigger as Democrats pile more and more, you know, entitlements and benefits that anyone who lives here is free to take from the taxpayers. And if we just allow anyone from across the world to come here, that's an obligation on our taxpayers. That will bankrupt us. It is bankrupting us. So that's the first reason why we cannot have open borders, and we have to enforce our laws around immigration. And the second reason is that so many on the left have been trying for so long to sell socialism to the American people, and we have rejected it generation after generation. And they've recognized this, so their new strategy is just to import new voters who will vote for socialism.
Exactly.
That is their strategy. They're very upfront about it. So we have to be a nation of laws when it comes to our immigration policy. We can't afford it, and it will destabilize our political system if we just let anyone and everyone come here, receive taxpayer-funded welfare benefits, and vote for what kind of government we're going to have going forward.
Right. I tell people frequently that the left has so long espoused zero population growth that they don't have enough people. They're not giving birth to enough people to replenish the Democratic Party. So what they're going to do is import them and bribe them with free stuff. Now, you make a statement on your website, Washington, D.C. is the richest region in America, and the rest of the country simply cannot afford for it to remain so. Expound on that, would you?
Well, the U.S. Census came out with the data that the five richest counties in America are all suburbs directly surrounding Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is the richest region in America. And so it begs a whole question, which is, how did they become the richest region in America? I mean, Washington, D.C., let's be honest, they're not known for producing anything of value, really. I mean, they're not known for manufacturing or agriculture or finance or really much of anything that's produced there. They're just known for one thing they do better than anywhere else in the country, and that's, we all know what that is. It's stealing from the rest of us. stealing from our paychecks with taxes, stealing from our future with debt, stealing from the very value of our savings and our retirements every time the Federal Reserve is printing new money out of thin air. And this system works incredibly well if you're one of the big guys in Washington, D.C. You know, the big well-connected corporations keep getting their corporate welfare payments. The big government just keeps growing bigger and bigger. Everyone in Washington, D.C. is doing well, but those of us across the country, those of us who work real jobs in the real economy, producing real goods and real services for real people, it all comes off of our backs. And I wish that was the worst thing that they were stealing from us. But they're also stealing from us something even far more precious. You know, Ronald Reagan told us a generation ago, he said that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. It's not something that's passed on through the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for the next generation for them to do the same. Or one day we'll spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children about that time in America when men and women were free. And that's also being stolen from us. Even far more precious than the dollars we earn are the liberties that so many have laid their lives down to fight and secure for us as Americans. And we can go through our entire Bill of Rights. You go through the First Amendment to the Tenth Amendment, with maybe the exception of the Third Amendment. There's no quartering of troops going on so far. But everything else, we can point to ways that our constitutional rights are being eradicated. And sadly, it's not just the Democrats. It's a lot of the establishment Republicans, too. And grassroots conservatives need to stand up. We need to fight back. And we need to reclaim our country, our liberties, and our Constitution.
Absolutely. We've just got a little over a minute or so left here. What is the penny plan?
The penny plan, if you cut one penny from every dollar in the federal budget, you would save trillions and you could balance the budget in 5 years. Senator Rand Paul has been advocating for this. And when I say a penny out of every dollar, I mean real cuts, not these fake cuts that we get out of Washington, D.C., where they say, well, we're planning to grow spending by 10%, and we're going to only grow it by 8%, so therefore that's a 2% cut. That's not a real cut. I'm talking about one penny out of every dollar off from the baseline of where we are right now. That would be that is a simple way we could get spending under control and make a difference. And if we're coming at the end of time, I just want to end by saying, if folks want to see another constitutional conservative voice in Washington, D.C., even if you don't live in Maine, there are so many ways you can help out. The establishment is not supporting us on this campaign, which is fine by me because it means I'm not going to owe them anything when we win and we get there. But if you want to, if anyone can go to our website, ericbrakey.com, and chip in $5, $10, $25, anything that you can afford to help elect a constitutional conservative. We have a huge chance in Maine. This is the least expensive U.S. Senate race we can win. Win this cycle. Your dollar in Maine goes further than anywhere else in the country. And you can be a part of this victory we're going to have this November. You can also follow us on Facebook at Eric Brakey for U.S. Senate, or follow me on Twitter at Senator Brakey, and the same on Instagram.
Wow. Wow. And I was going to mention your website, so that's fantastic. I've got it linked on the show page so people can, if they're looking at the show page, it is linked there. And but you definitely want to go to ericbrakey.com. I think that would be fantastic. And you would help kind of help with Susan Collins, who we never can count on for many conservative votes, but sounds like America could count on you. It's just been a pleasure meeting you online, on air, Eric, and I wish you all the best in the election.
The pleasure is all mine, Tammy. Thank you for having me on this evening.
You're welcome. Take care. You're listening to The Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. I will be back on the other side of the break with Catherine Glenn Foster. The Tammy Jackson Show is brought to you by Camera Security Now. Camera Security Now sells and installs surveillance and access control systems for business nationwide. Their turnkey surveillance access control systems provide an excellent management control tool. They go far beyond the obvious safety and security benefits. A site-wide surveillance system is the most cost-effective way to provide instant access to all the visual information that's critical to your business. Camera Security Now can handle your largest surveillance projects while still providing easy-to-reach personal service. With upfront pricing on itemized quotes, remote access to your surveillance system with no monthly fees, and same-day virtual site visits, you can rest assured your security needs are in capable hands. For more information, visit CameraSecurityNow.com or call 800 440-1662. That's CameraSecurityNow.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show.
You're on the 405.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
Whoa, a new digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Oh, I'm glad you like it, because I can't wait to toss the big stereo. And now that we got your dad that big HD TV he wanted, we can throw out our old TV, too.
Hold up. You can't just throw out electronics.
Really?
They need to be recycled or donated.
And how would we do that?
It's so easy, Mom. Today, recycling electronics is just as easy as buying them. GreenerGadgets.org has all the info. We just enter our zip code to find a certified recycling center nearby. There are thousands of them, and new ones are being added all the time. Some of our local stores are even certified recycling locations.
I like that.
Did you know that some of the stuff in our old electronics could be used to make new products and conserve natural resources?
Well, okay then. Let's gather them up. What was that website again?
GreenerGadgets.org. We just enter our zip code and go.
Children are at greater risk than adults from contaminants carried by floodwater. Since they dehydrate faster, they need to drink plenty of fluids. If the safety of your water is in question, either use bottled water or bring tap water to a rolling boil for at least 1 minute and let it cool before use. You should also keep children away from mud and make sure they don't play with anything that may have become polluted by floodwater or sludge. From the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
We are a bold and active voice for the unborn. We are Audio Girl Ministries, saving the lives of babies by helping moms in crisis pregnancies get past the crisis. How? Free ultrasound imaging so the woman can see the life she's carrying, and by supplying her with essential baby items, diapers, clothes, food, crib, car seat, all given with a loving and caring heart. Want to help? Log on to audiogirlministries.com and make a tax-deductible donation. audiogirlministries.com. Thanks.
I love Tammy.
I love you back, Kurt, because I'm a caring kind of gal.
The Tammy Jackson Show.
I'm just one conservative gal encouraging you to keep fighting the good fight.
Tammy is what conservative insurgency is about.
Tammy Jackson, the granddaughter of legal immigrants.
In Honduras, they had 60,000 murders per 100,000, something like that. And I thought, whoa, that is a lot.
Like every other person on the block is dead.
Tammy Jackson, the emerging threat from the West Coast.
Tammy has made herself into a rising radio star.
When we have these mass amounts just suddenly pour into the United States, we have a worse problem than we already have had with assimilation.
The Tammy Jackson Show, Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, only on the 405media.com.
Anything for you, Tammy.
The 405.
Welcome back. This is Tammy Jackson. I'm a little over halfway through the show. I'm joined by my guest, Catherine Glenn Foster. Catherine Glenn Foster is a wife, a mom, a top leader in the pro-life movement, as the president and CEO of Americans United for Life, America's first national pro-life organization and the nation's premier pro-life legal team. AUL's legal strategists have been involved in every pro-life case before the U.S. Supreme Court since Roe v. Wade. Catherine Glenn Foster, thanks for taking the time to be on the show tonight.
It is absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Wow. You are the president and CEO of Americans United for Life, AUL. But, yeah. But that's much more than just a job or a position. I would say it's probably a calling or a mandate for you. So I'd like to start out with your story, which is pretty amazing and touching and in some parts horrifying, I think. Would you tell us your story, why you are so passionate about the unborn and the mothers?
Absolutely. First of all, that is the exact word that I use. I do say that it is, in fact, a calling. So, I never really thought much about this issue as a child. You know, I had a couple of friends who would say that they were pro-life, and I didn't really even know what that meant. And I didn't really think about it until I was 19 years old. And at 19 years old, I found myself unexpectedly pregnant. It came out of nowhere. I went into the little clinic in my college, and I thought I had the flu or something. And they said, "Well, sure, we'll prescribe some medication for you, but first, could you just take this pregnancy test? You know, we just want to make sure that you're not pregnant before we give you this medicine. Why don't you take this pregnancy test?" And I said, "Well, of course I'm not pregnant, but sure, why not?" And I took the test and it came back positive. And I was shocked. I was floored. I had no idea how to handle it. I certainly wouldn't have ever expected that would have happened to me. Just like so many of the girls and the young women who today find themselves pregnant, who were trying to help. And the two nurses there at the clinic, they did everything that they could. I could see in their eyes that they wanted to say more, that there was more that they wanted to say or to share, but they didn't. It looked like they felt constrained. And so I Googled whatever search engine it was at the time. I Googled, pregnancy, what to do. And what came up? Abortion clinics. It was abortion clinics that came up. Okay. And, I thought, okay, well, at least I'll get some information there, right? I'll get some information, and then I'll be able to figure out a way forward here. And I picked the second cheapest one I could find. I thought, well, that'll be the safest. So it'll be okay. And I made an appointment for that Saturday. It was early. It was a couple of hours from my undergrad. And so we left early. And I got there and I'm sitting in the waiting room just surrounded by people who were on their second, third, fourth, fifth abortion. And I got the information. I took the pill that they gave me, just a painkiller kind of a pill. And they took me back. And I went and I lay down on a table and they started to do the ultrasound. And so my first thought is, I'm here for information. So I said, well, can you let me see that ultrasound? I want to see my baby. And they said, no, it's against policy. We don't let our women and girls see ultrasounds. And we know wow. why now. It's because when a woman sees an ultrasound, when a girl in an unplanned pregnancy sees an ultrasound, it's so hard for her to say, well, this isn't a human being. This isn't a baby. They choose life, and so they said that. So I've never actually been able to see a photo of my child, but they said that, and then they also said that in fact she was too young, that it was too early to have an abortion. And I said, well, okay, perfect. There's the answer. That's the out I'm looking for, because I had hoped that perhaps I would just find someone who would listen and understand and talk with me and point me in the right direction towards resources and just ensure that I had someone to sit beside me and hold my hand while I called my mom and told her. And I never found that. I didn't find that in the clinic with the nurses. I didn't find that in the abortion clinic with the staff there. It was totally absent. And so when they said, well, she's too young, I said, well, there's my answer. I'll leave, fine. It's too far of a distance. I'm already bonding. I can't come back another Saturday. And they said, well, let us check again. And they wanted me again. And they said, you know what? It turns out she's big enough after all. And so I got escorted back, shifted back to the next room, the next step in this assembly line procedure. So I go to that next room and I'm lying on the table and all of a sudden I just think, you know, I was here for information. I can't do this. This is wrong. This is wrong. And I tried to get up. And the staff member who was in the room with me at the time, she called for help. And three more people came on in. And I ended up with one person on each arm, one on each leg. And then the doctor finally came in at that point. First time I sent the doctor. And it was over in about 5 minutes. I was screaming. I was trying to get up. There was nothing I could do.
Yeah.
It was horrible. Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, and it's not a choice. That is not a choice.
No.
That's not compassion. That's not a choice. I wanted people to hear your story because I heard you give it when you were on CBN, and I read about it, and I was just horrified. And I know from friends that have endured not quite that, but they've had abortions when they were younger. One gal especially gives her testimony all the time, and because she now has found grace and forgiveness in her life and has healed emotionally and spiritually, but it left a scar that was very tough for her for years and years and years. And she did not find anything remotely like compassion at the abortion clinic, and that's what we're seeing. It's not compassion. And the reason I wanted to have you on to talk about this, because this is a big thing, and life to me is one of the most important things in our nation. I know a lot of people like to shove it aside and say, oh, it's a social issue, don't talk about that. But you know what, if we don't have the right to life, we have the right to nothing else in this nation. And
you are so right.
Yeah. And so now here we are with Judge Kavanaugh. His hearings will be coming up shortly. He could be a next Supreme Court justice. And it seems that there are some things on the docket that might do something to roll back Roe v. Wade or Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which are blatant examples of judicial activism. Would you talk a little bit, what are your thoughts about Judge Kavanaugh, his judicial philosophy and judicial temperament?
You know, the one thing that we know about Judge Kavanaugh in this regard is that he is a judicial originalist, a textualist, someone who understands and appreciates that his highest calling and duty and responsibility is to the U.S. Constitution and to the rule of law. That is what he is called upon to interpret, to uphold, to ensure that everything flows from that. And so with that, we know that the rule of law includes the right to life, that intrinsic right to life. And so we do believe that he sees this. Now, of course, during a confirmation process, we don't discuss how a judge would rule in a particular matter, in a particular upcoming case, or even an area of case law. It's simply not how this process is designed to work. It politicizes the process unnecessarily and incorrectly, really. So in terms of, you know, would he overturn Roe? We can't specifically say that, but we do know that he is a strongly committed originalist judge, committed to the Constitution, and that is a very promising sign.
You know, I want to talk about, there are some cases coming up on the Supreme Court docket. What cases are coming up? How could Roe even be approached with these cases that are coming up?
Sure. Well, I think before we even address that, we should probably first correct a misconception that's going around about overturning Roe v. Wade.
Oh, yeah.
Because what we've seen is that the left is promoting this theory, this wrong-headed notion, in fact, that, in fact, when Roe is overturned, that all of a sudden, the next day, abortion is going to be illegal and banned nationwide, and the nation's women will somehow, you know, have no options. And of course, looking back to Planned Parenthood v. Casey and that reliance interest that the court came up with there, that mistaken notion that women rely upon Roe v. Wade, upon legalized abortion in order to arrange and to plan our education, our careers, our families, our futures, simply wrong. We've seen all the different ways that abortion is harming life, it's harming women, it's harming health and the family and society and culture. And in fact, we just had a symposium on that a few short weeks ago. But in terms of the cases that could come up, the Supreme Court has the latitude to potentially address this issue in any number of different cases. Anything really relating to abortion, and there are several of those in the pipeline. We've seen, in particular, there is a Medicaid funding case, a couple of cases on Medicaid funding that are before the court. The court is deciding whether or not to hear, and that would be potentially one avenue. There are other avenues as well, and there are so many cases currently out there, currently making their way slowly through the courts. In so many cases, you'll see Planned Parenthood, and they're just, you know, they don't like state laws. You know, they think they see an opening, a loophole. And so with Roe, and then with Casey in 92, and then with Hellerstedt, Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt in 2016, yeah, you see that sometimes they'll start to see that they may have a loophole. And at that point, they'll start to sue. And they'll say, well, you know, we have this right, and this law, you know, infringes upon this right. You know, it impedes access. It's problematic for us. And so, you know, we have cases where right now in the court system where Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry, they are attacking good pro-life laws wholesale, trying to strike down whole swaths of pro-life law that we have worked decades to build up. And some of these cases are exactly the cases where the next Supreme Court with whether it's Kavanaugh or the next Supreme Court justice will have an opportunity to revisit Roe v. Wade, to revisit that abortion line of cases.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's interesting. If you're just tuning in now, my guest is Catherine Glenn Foster. She is the president and CEO of Americans United for Life. But in case you're wondering how she knows so much about this, she's also a doctor of jurisprudence. She's admitted to the bar in Virginia, Washington, D.C., as well as the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Courts of Appeals for the 1st, 5th, 8th, 9th Circuits, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. She's a member of the American Bar Association, the Federal Bar Association, etc. She's extremely qualified to be talking about this. And one thing that you mentioned, Catherine, is about Roe v. Wade and the nonsense going around that if it's overturned, you hear NARAL and Planned Parenthood and other extremists yelling things about back alley abortions and cone hangers and their lies. And that shouldn't surprise
I've experienced
us.
That.
Yeah. And that right. shouldn't. Exactly. You've experienced it. And it should not surprise us, Catherine Glenn Foster, because these are the same people that cheered for Roe v. Wade, which was a case of judicial activism built upon lies.
That's absolutely right. And you know what? That is recognized on both the left and the right. When even Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's one of the most committed abortion advocates in our country, when even she recognizes and affirms that Roe is the most extreme law in the country, that's quote, when she says that it went too far too fast, when she says, you know, it was wrongly decided, when some of the leading liberal legal scholars, law professors of our day recognize exactly how deeply flawed Roe is as a matter of constitutional law, when you see that even Justice Blackmun, who authored the Roe decision, when even he says, or one of his law clerks says that in fact Roe was not grounded in any kind of constitutional right, that it's just completely adrift, then you know that it is in fact deeply flawed, and we do expect it to be overturned. And that's exactly why in 1992, in the Planned Parenthood v. Casey case, the justices there, they knew that they couldn't really defend Roe on terms. That they couldn't say, well, you know, Roe is accurate, it's constitutionally grounded, it's well-reasoned. And so that is exactly why Justice Kennedy, in that case, he found another way to do it. And so what they did in the Supreme Court, they decided that they were going to uphold the fundamental holding of Roe. They were going to say, well, you know, we still want that policy preference. We're gonna agree with the policy preference. You know, we're pro-choice. But fine, okay, Roe wasn't well decided or well reasoned, so we're gonna find another way to ground it in the Constitution. And so Justice Kennedy, who of course just retired at the end of June, what he did it was his opinion, he wrote that opinion. He said in that opinion, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. And he called that, but scholars since have called that the sort of sweet mystery of life passage, because it's so philosophical. It's again, completely adrift from constitutional law. And what they said is, okay, fine. When you look at stare decisis, when you look at the principles of when you follow precedent, Roe may be indefensible on most of those. But,
yes.
But they said that women have come to rely upon legalized abortion in order to arrange, as I said, our education, our careers. And so, therefore, women have come to rely upon abortion over the last, at the time, 20 or so years. And so, therefore, we cannot go back. It's that same kind of back alley argument, just dressed up in fancier words.
Wow. You know, as you're talking about that, it just everything about Roe, and I'm not a scholar and I'm not a lawyer, anything like that, but I've read about this, I've studied about it, and I was absolutely flabbergasted and amazed and aghast that the Berger Court could find in favor of the right to privacy over the right to life for the child. And they even punted that and said, we'll leave the notion of when life begins to another argument. For right now, we're just deciding on the right to privacy. And I thought, oh my goodness.
And that's not critical.
Yeah, right. Yes. And I thought, oh, okay, the right to life versus the right to privacy? Wait a minute, you can't even have privacy if you don't have life in the first place. What are you people talking about? And suddenly you're making yourselves God or something and saying that it's okay to extinguish these little lives. There was no precedent, as you mentioned. Now, one of the things, would you just briefly talk about what is undue burden? That's what they decide. They threw out that term in Planned Parenthood v. Casey.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So when you look at undue burden, it's another one of those ideas that we're still trying to wrap our heads around. What constitutes a burden? And often we're talking about access, right? And so what constitutes access? Now, and the whole Women's Health v. Hellerstedt case, we were talking about clinics in Texas. And what if there's no clinic out in some rural part of Texas? Well, interestingly, the placement of clinics is a business decision. When you look at the ratio of pro-life pregnancy centers, for example, to abortion clinics, they outnumber abortion clinics 5-1. When you look at the ratio of community health centers and government qualified health centers, they outnumber abortion clinics 19-1. They are in our backyards, in our hometowns, in all the different parts of America that the abortion industry, as a business decision, has decided not to engage in and enter the marketplace in. So that is their decision. And in fact, this isn't the most scientific survey. I'm sure there are some places where it would be even more remote. But one time I went on my phone. I was just curious. And I searched from a northern point in Maine to the nearest abortion clinic. And I determined that just based on my map on my phone, it was going to take 10 hours to drive to the nearest abortion clinic and include driving through Canada to get there. The road would take you through Canada. So this is a business decision for the abortion industry. This is not something where they're in it out of the goodness of their heart. You know, they could place clinics anywhere they want, more or less. I mean, some states have health and safety regulations to try to at least protect women's health and safety and this process. But they can certainly open clinics, and they often choose not to. So when you look at, for example, Texas and that idea about access and how far you have to go to access a clinic, well, it is the abortion industry that is choosing to move to this mega clinic model. It is the abortion industry that is choosing to shut down their smaller clinics that are sort of dotted across the land and to move towards these giant clinics, sometimes multi-story clinics, and perform abortions there and major population centers. Yeah, right. That's what we see.
Well, we're coming up on the end of the half hour. I knew it would go really, really fast. This is something that is so near and dear to my heart, and I am just grateful to get to know you a little bit in this short conversation, Catherine Glenn Foster. I want everybody to look on the show page. I've got the Americans United for Life is linked, the website, AUL.org. I'd like people to go there to find out more about what you all do. And Catherine Glenn Foster, thank you for doing what you do for the cause of life.
It's a calling, just like we were talking about. It is absolutely a calling. And anytime I can help to save a life or to protect a woman, that's exactly where I am called to be.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. I'll have you back on again sometime.
I would love that. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet.
Take care.
Thanks for listening, everybody. The Tammy Jackson Show on the 405 will be back next week with more great guests. And in 2 weeks, my guests will be none other than Alan Robertson and his dad, the Duck Commander himself and patriarch of the Robertson family, Phil Robertson. You don't want to miss it 2 weeks from tonight. Until then, this is Tammy Jackson reminding you to wake up. Don't be silent. Let your voice be heard because we have a country to save.
Cut my teeth on the back of an old church pew. I learned to walk in the ways of light and truth. And I was told not to speak till I was spoken to. I heard it preach what I should and I should not do. And the choir sang, a good boy, but I ain't a boy no more. I've seen some things that a man just can't ignore, and this world's gonna see what I'm standing for. I've kept my peace, but I can't hold my tongue anymore. You can't buy my silence, you can't steal my voice, you can't down, tell me to shut my mouth, but there's a time to speak, and the time is now. The squeaky wheel is always getting grease. Well, I've been sitting still, on the side of the street, always tiptoeing
head.